the unveiling of the company of heaven. Every man and every woman is a star.
Eric Scott Picard, joined as ever by Patrick Ryan. And tonight we are having a returning guest. That would be Mark Korski. I'm just going to read his bio briefly from his webpage. Mark Korski is a homegrown anarchist political philosopher. Born in 1951, he studied mathematics and physics at the University of Colorado and taught those subjects for 35 years. He lives in New Mexico, where he thinks, writes, and produces films in collaboration with Justin Jezuski's Reckless Aesthetics. Mark is he's a friend of the podcast, and he's the author of a book that we're very impressed with, which is Engines of Domination. There's a film in coordination with Justin Jezuski's Reckless Aesthetics on YouTube that you can take a look at, Engines of Domination as well, which summarizes the core ideas. That's when we first kind of became aware of Mark's work. And again, we're just incredibly impressed with it. So tonight we're going to follow up on some of those ideas and talk about some of the forthcoming projects and some projects that have been released in the meantime from Mark and Justin as well. So Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much, Eric. It's great to be back. Been looking forward to it.
No, absolutely, absolutely, and this interview has been in the works for the last couple of months. It's really great to have you. I don't know. We've conversed a lot since the last interview. You've produced some new work, and you've sent me some work that we want to talk about tonight. I guess let's just start though. Well, one thing I think is very interesting about you is that you've written many times that you didn't arrive at the anarchist philosophy through reading any anarchists, really.
No,
you
really,
arrived at it on your own.
I decided on anarchism in my youth, kind of as a consequence of a short psychotic enchantment with Ayn Rand. But it wasn't really a theoretical idea of anarchism. I worked out my own version completely on my own over several decades, without reading. I read the works, some of the works of Chomsky, but they were about American foreign policy, not about theoretical anarchism.
Yeah, exactly. And you mostly were studying scientific philosophers, correct? You write a lot about Karl Popper.
I studied Popper in depth for several decades. It was the biggest influence on me philosophically overall, but not in the social sphere. In epistemology, Popper was really quite radical and groundbreaking. We owe the idea of critical rationalism to him, and the idea that what makes a theory scientific is that it can be refuted by experiments or by critical reasoning. in social philosophy, he was very much in the London School of Economics, Friedrich von Hayek line of thought, kind of, you might call it neo-Whiggism. Socially liberal, definitely believed in personal freedom and was adamantly against tyranny. But as far as he went in the direction of freedom was to say that his idea of an open society was one where the people could get rid of their rulers without violence. He believed rulers were absolutely necessary, but that society, the government should be organized for the common good. So anyway, what I got from him was epistemology and metaphysics. Popper, in his later years, worked out a number of really beautiful theories, one of them about how to interpret probability in quantum mechanics. And that was formative for the work I sent you, my little essay on the war on reality. And he also did a lot of work about dualism and human freedom in the psychological sense. Dualism by proposing a theory that there is more than just the physical world that's real, that there are actually at least three: the physical world, the world of conscious states, and the world of human creations, including language, theories, artifacts, that these are equally real and each of them can affect the other. That's one of his later beautiful theories. And the theory on human freedom is that this world of conscious states isn't strictly determined by the physical world, that it has an autonomy and is able to actually act on the other worlds independently. So we aren't just strictly determined electrochemical mechanisms going through our emotions while we think we're really free. So he was a huge influence also in my method of working philosophically. I didn't study philosophy of science in depth by studying other thinkers. I much prefer to study a few that I can get a great deal out of and really digest completely.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. Sure. That you can really digest and kind of pick apart. Sure. And I've always found that interesting. You know, most of the anarchists that we'd have on the show in the modern day, you know, these are people who would have been reading Kropotkin. You know what I mean? Usually starting via Marx and moving into like Bakunin, you know, Kropotkin, Emma Goldman. You know, so I've always just found it interesting that you arrived at this extremely concise program that you outline in Engines of Domination without having built on that, you know.
Well, it's a drawback in a way. I know I've still never studied those people. I love Mutual Aid, but mm-hmm. and Proudhon's What is Property is another masterpiece. But I've missed a huge amount of great seminal thinking by working on my own. On the other hand, it gives my work, I've repeated on my own, I've rediscovered, so to speak, I've reinvented the wheel, I've reinvented jillions of wheels, and to find that you can arrive at the same conclusions by a different line of reasoning is some indication that there may be something to those conclusions. You know, if everybody reaches out and says, my goodness, this is a pumpkin I'm feeling in this dark room, it may be a pumpkin. It was really a major decision early in my life, early in my thinking life in college. I studied a tradition of mathematics called the Moore method. This wonderful mathematician in Texas had found that he taught his students best by giving them just a list of axioms and definitions and a list of theorems to prove, to build an entire mathematical system on their own, rather than just ingesting all that stuff from a text and then working problems. So I was lucky enough to study with a teacher who taught that method. And when I decided I needed to think world affairs out for myself back in my early 30s, I just stuck to that and decided I had to put the ingredients of my own theory together and work out its conclusions all on my own. So it also kind of gives my system a purity because I'm not mixing a whole bunch of other sources together and trying to come up with some brew of them. It was just exactly what I was able to think out, stated as clearly as I could.
Yeah, absolutely, and it comes across. And I think you have a highly original thesis. If we could just go to Engines of Domination real quick and and talk about that for people who may not have heard the previous show or are familiar with your work. The thesis it's a very interesting scientific one, is that an engine scientifically is a machine that turns energy into useful work. And so what Mark, if I'm correct here in my thesis, is saying is that government structures, institutional structures, structures of power and hierarchy turn human energy into useful work that propagates the owners of the engine, the people in power. Am I summing that up correctly, Mark?
Yeah, it's a device that converts the human energy. It's a set of institutions. See, an engine doesn't have to be a machine. A solar cell is an engine
Right.
because it makes currents run from sunlight. It's a system of institutions whose purpose is to capture the human energy of a community and the riches of its habitat indirectly and convert those into power and privilege for the people who run the engine. It's an immaterial engine, but it's still an engine.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the fundamental idea. I would encourage people, I'd like to move on to this essay and some of your other work as well, but I'd encourage people to listen to the previous show and to read and especially to watch Engines of Domination. You can find the video on YouTube. We'll tell you about Mark's contact information later, but it's a very interesting idea and it's quite I don't know, it's a different way of looking at political issues than I've heard from most people.
I'd like to add one thing, if I may, Eric.
Absolutely.
To regard it as an engine is to regard it as an invention. The other half of my theory is to insist that this isn't part of human nature, like the structures, the dominant structures in anthills or wolf packs. It's an innovation that was created about 6,000 years ago when there were, by the standards of that time, wealthy, stable, prosperous agricultural communities that had enough organized and concentrated human energy to make it worthwhile for some people to domesticate the rest of the community. So, yes, it's an engine. That's the specific kind of innovation it is, but it's an innovation, not an expression of human nature. In fact, it acts contrary to human nature, which is fundamentally cooperative.
And that really is, I think, at the key crux of of pretty much all these political philosophical ideals. I mean, I've heard the argument made about capitalism so many times. I can't even tell you how many times, especially people that follow the sort of Ayn Randian type version, that, oh, well, humans are inherently selfish. This is just a way for us to express that selfishness without killing each other, participating in this marketplace. So they all sort of take this interpretation of nature and try to apply it on a social mass scale, and their interpretation, more often than not, is typically totally skewed.
That's absolutely true, and they are so mistaken in terms of anthropology and psychology and sociology about how people really tick. But it's a great inspiration to be selfish and go out and get what you can and to feel like the more you get, the more you deserved it, and that the world, that this is the natural order of things, this incredibly unnatural order of capitalism that isn't more than 500 years old.
Right, exactly. And it's really I think that's the we kind of have it going backwards, where instead of going and observing nature without all the preconceived ideas and sort of coming to the conclusion that way, we've sort of we're putting these conceptual frames on what nature is before we've actually really given it an in-depth study, or before we've really come to any solid conclusions. And I mean that even today in the scientific endeavors.
Sure, it began with social Darwinism, which was an apologetic for the capitalist, industrialist, imperialist system of Britain,
Absolutely.
projecting the traits, the deviant traits of the ruling classes on humanity at large.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, certainly. It seems like there have been numerous times through history scientific apologetics made for existing colonial and imperialist practices. For example, racism, the structure of racism is clearly scientifically indefensible now, but there were many scientists in the 18th century, even in the 19th century, who did a lot of work trying to prove that there was some racial difference,
Oh,
right?
sure.
That there was some superiority inherent in the, well, whatever race they picked, usually Caucasian of some kind, whiteness wasn't included to the entirety of Europe for many centuries.
I'm sure there were rationalizations for the caste system in India, probably more metaphysics. I mean, there wasn't science in our sense, and with anything like the influence it has today. Then how about Aristotle and his justifications for slavery? It goes way back. The people on top always propagate an ideology that justifies their position.
And it seems like fundamentally the engine of domination, as you would call it, predated many of these rationalizations.
Well, I'm not sure. In its origins, it must have, because people had to be in power before they needed to justify it. But from the earliest times in Egypt and Samaria, the monarchs were depicted as divine or as kings. Same thing.
Using religion as, I suppose that's a good segue there. Using a religious sense instead of a scientific one to justify hierarchical, situations of domination. In this essay, "The War on Reality," you talk about what you call scientism, and that's a term I've heard not just in your work but elsewhere. Capital S scientism. As an ideology, as opposed to science, right? The discipline of science, right? Could you elaborate maybe a little bit on what you mean in the essay, which I encourage people to, you can tell us if they can find the essay anywhere. I encourage people to read it. What do you mean by scientism, capital S scientism?
I should start with the fact, with reiterating the fact that probably everybody knows that modern science arose as a radical movement. The natural and experimental philosophers, starting before Galileo in the 16th century, were challenging centuries and centuries of entrenched church authority, where the doctors of the church had used Aristotle and other traditional sources to lay down how the world must be. And these guys started actually experimentally checking it out. So it was a huge challenge to authority. And as the movement grew through the time of Newton, it became a challenge not only to the intellectual authorities, but to the political authorities. Because, man, these bright guys could be trouble if they started thinking about how the society worked in the same way they're thinking about how the planets work. So science began as a really radical movement. Then, on the other hand, from its inception, it was understood by those in power to be a great potential source of further power. Francis Bacon wrote, "Knowledge is power," and he meant political power. The seal and legitimate goal of the sciences is to endow humanity with new inventions and riches, he wrote. And the Royal Society of London was founded in the 17th century under a royal charter, and its first committee's purpose was to examine all something like to imagine in, examine all tools and inventions or something like that. So from the start, there was both the radical side and the understanding by power that this new radical movement could be really helpful to them if they could harness it in. The Industrial Revolution seemed to prove what Bacon was saying. these new devices and techniques that were derived from scientific laws and principles actually brought a whole new ruling class to power, the industrialists and the financiers that included some of them and that supported them.
Yeah.
From then on, there was no question that science would be decisive in the future of power, economic and political power. At the same time, the Enlightenment and the further offshoots, philosophical offshoots of the scientific movement had spawned an awful lot of wonderful free thought, Rousseau and so forth, but also they'd begun to spin off, as I mentioned earlier, things like social Darwinism that sought to justify the behavior of those in power on supposedly scientific grounds. The status of science increased enormously. People began to distinguish that a realistic, correct outlook on the world was scientific, and anything else was superstitious and contemptible. By the early 20th century, it was common to speak of science as some marvelous, exalted thing that produced unquestionable truth and would unleash limitless human capabilities through technology. That's what I mean by scientism, a glorification of science, literally as a kind of superhero that will liberate us from ignorance and give us superhuman powers, and an exaltation of the findings of science to some kind of absolute truth, which is totally contrary to the real nature of science, which is a very humble and fallible human enterprise. All the great scientists admit to this, back to the time of Newton through Einstein. Scientific truth is provisional. What the best we can say is that our theories about the world today have withstood severe experimental testing and critical thinking to find their errors. The most successful theories of the past, like Newtonian mechanics, passed every test for 300 years before new facts were discovered that showed that it was incorrect. So the idea that scientific truth is absolute and unquestionable is really nonsense. But scientism, if it doesn't state that explicitly, it implies it. That here is the truth, and we've got it, we scientists. So that's what I mean by scientism, an ideology that glorifies science and very significantly endows it with superhuman capabilities beyond those that were ever possible to human beings before.
It's really like the antithesis to science, scientism.
Yep.
You know, I mean, I think you said that beautifully on a number of levels, but the idea that the fundamental aspect of science is really to disprove rather than prove.
Well, it's a dialogue. Popper described it as conjectures and refutations. Scientists think up theories and then create experimental conditions to find out whether what those theories predict actually occurs. That doesn't prove that the theory's right, but if it withstands the test, it shows that the theory may be something close to the truth. So you can't have one without the other. You have to have the creative production of theories, and they're being submitted to critical analysis and experimental testing.
Yeah, exactly. And it seems like in scientism, they're kind of replacing the ideology of God or religion or spirituality with science, right? Capital S science. And that's never what it was really supposed to be. As you said, it's supposed to be this dialogue, a search for the truth, like, you know, what Joseph Campbell would call the hero's journey, you know, like the journey is essentially greater than the end truth, right? It's supposed to be a seeking after the truth.
Popper wrote an autobiography of ideas called The Unended Quest.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that's exactly what happened. As the church authority crumbled and the secular authorities that had depended on it, science inherited that authority. And it was almost like there was a vacuum, an authority vacuum, an intellectual authority vacuum that science stepped into. It's gone much farther, though, in the 20th century. Now scientism has become a marketing device for federally subsidized private research that leads to nothing but profits, to new destructive and commercial devices that can make companies big money. Progress exactly. is our most important product was the motto of GE when I was a boy. I remember Ronald Reagan saying that on TV when he was their spokesman. It's become a marketing device because you have to keep the public behind the subsidies to companies like the aerospace companies, to government organizations like NASA. You see it all the time. In the whole space program, the great thing is we're searching for life out there. Oh, we found a new Earth-like planet, which turns out to mean that they found a planet that's about as far from its star as it would need to be to have temperatures like those on the Earth. Right. That's it. But the pictures show this beautiful Earth-like globe with oceans and greenery. It's become a huge amount of hype. Science has been industrialized in the 20th century. It used to be pursued by a relatively small number of very privileged but senior academics. There were important exceptions, like the brewer Joule, who had a big impact on thermodynamics with his studies of energy. We named the unit of energy after Joule. Big exceptions. Faraday was also just a scientific amateur and a brilliant teacher who did experiments that revolutionized electromagnetism. But most of them, from the 18th century on, were well-established academics. Now it's become a huge money-making business to do science. And that's very dangerous, as I'm sure you guys understand.
I totally agree with that. And certainly the fact that science has been industrialized, it's something I've been thinking of often. Lately, I'm working on a piece about waste inherent in the capitalist system. And it seems like, for example, look at the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, you might be a brilliant young person, goes to school for chemistry, and you end up employed for one of these big pharmaceutical companies, like Pfizer, for example. And you end up designing pills that are essentially the same pill that came out 4 or 5 years ago with all of these side effects to solve a problem that nobody really has. You know what I mean? Like a pill for, to make your penis work better. You know what I mean? Which has all these, this list of long laundry list of side effects. Is that really the proper use of intellectual energy?
It's a terrible and a partly deliberate waste. Because it channels energy that could go into really creative work that serves human well-being into something that simply makes the dividends a little bigger. And it is, in the side effects, at great expense to human well-being. It's a perversion.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And yet the scientific system that we have now is kind of held up as being some kind of it's almost messianic, Mark. I've seen people, especially people in like the new atheist community, who see this scientism as being this messianic force, and I just don't see it that way.
It is, scientism is that way, but scientism isn't science.
Yeah.
It's very dangerous. It's become an accessory to power, and as this hydrogen bomb obviously attests, but
the finest example of,
more important, it is impossible to manufacture knowledge like you manufacture cars. Supposedly, the scientific method that supposedly is the essence of science that you find at the beginning of every science textbook I've ever looked at, it doesn't exist. There is no method for discovering new truth because there's no method for having the creative ideas you need for the theories that lead to it or for the experiments that can determine facts or test theories. But if you go through those motions and write a paper on it, you are a scientist, and it is research, and knowledge has been enlarged. It's become a ritual.
Yeah, that's it is almost, it's ritualistic. Another metaphor that occurs to me, we've been using, for example, the same internal combustion engine for at least the last 100 years. Most of the scientific work that goes into producing new cars goes into making it more attractive for a consumer, not improving the base technology. Again, this is a wasteful use of energy.
Well, it is. The making it more attractive to consumers is certainly a waste of energy. And the planned obsolescence that makes, you know, today's car impossible to fix by the mechanical methods of 10 years ago. But it seems to me that the internal combustion engine may be something that's perfected, like the shovel is perfected. And the improvements in that engine have leveled off steadily over the last 100 years. Some things can't be improved on. How the rest of the car works could possibly be improved on. But there are such things as summits in technological development.
Yeah, that's a good point. That is a good point. However, it seems like the industrial science system has not provided us with the means to change the infrastructure to use a new or better form of engine.
No, it certainly hasn't. And you could probably build them in simpler, more efficient, and easily repaired ways, which would partly be a retrogression to the original engines, which were very easily repaired. That would make it tons easier and cheaper for the consumers, and therefore it's not done.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So this is, scientism, would you say, is one facet of the engine of domination in the modern era?
It's become absolutely essential because the experts who are consulted in policymaking and who write policy wear the credentials of science.
Right.
Right. They wear the priestly smock.
Yeah, exactly. So again, scientism has kind of replaced the state religions. For example, the Roman Empire. You know, they a deeply religious people, but not very spiritual. They used their state religion as a means of social control. We've now, in the capitalist era, turned toward scientific pursuits to fill that void.
Sure have.
Yeah. Elsewhere in the essay, you talk about supernature a little bit. And you make the important distinction that you're not talking about, as supernatural in the sense of, I think you put it as, seances and things like that, you make a distinction. You want to talk about what you mean by supernature, supernatural?
Yes. In the process of trying to solve another problem, I posed the question to myself, what might it mean for something to be supernatural if it didn't mean some very questionable, if not ridiculous, stuff like seances and so forth, like the occult? And I decided on to describe supernature as that which cannot in principle ever be explained by science. To make that more precise, a scientific explanation, according to Popper's epistemology, which is the only one I use, a scientific explanation of something has to show how that thing necessarily results from certain laws of nature when certain conditions occur. If you know the tensile strength of a string, then if you ask what will happen if I hang a weight greater than the string can support from the string, you can deduce from the properties of the string and from the law of gravity that the string will break or not break. It's a very specific kind of explanation, and it's very rigorous because the laws of nature are quantitative. They don't say this sort of happens after that sort of happens. They say this quantity varies with this quantity according to some equation. So first of all, they're about quantities, and they're quantities that vary in mathematically precise ways. Of course, that makes a strict scientific explanation a very fancy and often impossible thing. So by supernature, I decided to mean what could never be explained that way, not what can't be explained that way now, but what in principle science will never be able to explain. So in particular, I'm restricting myself to stuff we know about. I'm not talking about supernature as something like ethereal spirits that we channel. I'm talking about real, observable, quantifiable occurrences in our universe that will always elude scientific explanation.
Like, what are some examples?
Well, I make an argument in my essay that the most familiar example is people. That human beings are not explainable scientifically. And I give a number of qualities of human beings that illustrate why I believe that. The most particular one probably to mention here is consciousness. There is no scientific theory of consciousness. There are immense volumes of scientific theories about neural processes and activations in the nervous system of human beings and how the brain works. And I certainly know we're learning more and more about the brain all the time, but it is purely a dogma that consciousness is nothing but brain activity. How would you test that scientifically?
Exactly.
How would you even scientifically characterize and quantify consciousness? There is nothing like consciousness in our entire known universe. There's nothing even kind of like it. This quality of immediate, vivid, conscious experience that we all have whenever we are doing anything, wherever we are, that's unique. And you can't even ask common scientific questions about it, like, where is it? Is it really inside your brain? Is it even inside your skin? We're certainly uniquely conscious of things inside our skin, but we're conscious of things outside them. Very well-documented paranormal experiences, like telepathy and clairvoyance, strongly suggest that our consciousness is not limited to the inside of our skin, so we can be aware of events at least at a distance and maybe in time. Leaving that aside, though, it's you can also not ask, what is consciousness made of? Now, there are some other things in science that you can't ask that about. Like, you can't ask what energy is made of, because energy is an abstract quantity that you calculate given certain properties of a physical system. But no one thinks that consciousness is just a kind of energy, because energy isn't a stuff. Consciousness may not be a stuff, but it's certainly remarkable that you can't ask what kind of thing it is. So it's unique. And to say that it's just a spin-off of neurochemical processes, the idea that it's what philosophers call an epiphenomenon, that either is irrelevant to those processes and just an illusion we have, or that it's simply something that runs in parallel, kind of like the shadow of a moving object on a wall. You know, the shadow isn't the object. The object in that analogy would be the brain processes. And the shadow would just be what we seem to be aware of. That's a dogma, and it reflects how impervious science is to being able to characterize consciousness scientifically, that most philosophers of mind and neurosciences seem to argue that consciousness isn't important and doesn't need explaining, this epiphenomenon idea. So I think just on grounds that we are conscious and deliberately and self-conscious beings, that's a strong argument that we may be supernatural beings. Of course, the idea of supernature is refutable. It's a scientific theory. If we one day arrive at a place where science can scientifically explain everything, we would know that supernature didn't exist. On the other hand, if one supernatural being does exist, then the philosophy of materialism, that there's nothing but the material universe that science can explain, that would be refuted.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, I've seen it so many times with a lot of these new neo-atheists and a lot of my friends that are, you know, in that sort of, have taken that sort of ideological avenue. And it just seems like, you know, not only is this type of thinking sort of inherently dehumanizing, but just this whole, like, the brash conclusions a lot of these people will come to, you know, and they'll call themselves scientists, but I feel like they're so eager to just jump to this sort of reductionistic conclusion on certain things. Like, for example, you know, I had gotten into an argument with a close friend, and I was talking about Chinese medicine, and I was, you know, describing sort of the concepts, and immediately he has barely any idea of what Chinese medicine is. immediately says, oh, it's all bullshit. And I'm trying to explain to him, well, you know, how could you just jump to this massive conclusion that it's all bullshit, throw it all under the umbrella word of all, right? Just because it's not endorsed by the scientific community or some of the concepts don't follow what we would call, you know, biological laws or so forth and so on. To make that brash of a statement that there is no God or all alternative medicine is bullshit or, you know, it goes on and on and on. I feel like that is totally unscientific. It's like,
sure,
you know, why not embrace the mystery of it all? You know, it doesn't mean you have to agree with it all 100%. But hey, maybe the ancient Chinese were onto something with certain things, you know, for example, qi and whatnot. Maybe there is some sort of higher intelligence or, you know, spirit out there. You know, it's like by saying there isn't at all, end of story, case closed, we're cutting ourselves off from that path of inquiry.
Those people who say that certainly are. It's a dogma. That's exactly how the church treated the scientific ideas back in the 16th century. And they had the power to burn Giordano Bruno at the stake for it. It's the opposite of science. It's just that scientism speaking. It's a closed-minded ideology that condemns anything that falls outside its own view of the world. And if science doesn't know it, it isn't known, as I said earlier. It's,
including what you were just saying, you know, a few minutes ago, Mark, you know, I mean, you made a very concise, you had a very concise discussion of consciousness, right? And that argument is one that I'm involved with all the time, the argument of consciousness and free will, right? People get extraordinarily dogmatic about that. You presented it in a way that I think is very important. You presented it in a way that, you know, this, you know, the idea of supernature, of the supernatural, is a hypothesis, right? And we could posit it in scientific terms. But when the majority of the scientific community refutes it in a manner that is dogmatic, that is not according to the scientific method and process, it clearly shows that there is a dogmatic, you know, society at work, a culture of dogmatism at work, which is very similar to the church during the early scientific era.
Yeah, exactly. They're the authorities now, and ideas like that challenge their authority and have to be dismissed. I should emphasize for your listeners, I studied theoretical physics for 7 years. I am no enemy of science. I love it. Mm-hmm. I've taught it. I used to read the Feynman lectures on physics every night while I ate supper. It's a big part of my life, and I love it. I love the thing, and I can actually still do some physics if I sit down with a pencil and paper. So this is not a personal vendetta against something that I don't know about or have an irrational dislike of.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
In fact, science is one of the reasons why I believe that human beings are supernatural beings. The tremendous creativity of people that made science among all the things that distinguish us from other animals, that made science possible, is inexplicable. If we don't know even what consciousness is, or how to deal with it scientifically, we certainly don't have any scientific understanding of creative thought, where these not just ideas, but symphonies, inventions, ways of solving human problems, how this happens, to scientifically explain that would mean to show that it has to be that way, given certain laws of nature and certain prior initial conditions. This is obviously way beyond even the imagination of science today, and there is no reason whatever to think that it ever will be, that we'd have a complete and definitive explanation of the universe that included human beings, because a complete and definitive explanation of everything would have to include an explanation of how that explanation was possible, which brings you to human creativity, consciousness, thought, language.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, and it should be said also, you know, I mean, I'm a huge fan of the advancements of science. You know, Pat is as well. You know, we're highly highly appreciative of the technology that we have today and the advancements of science. I have no hatred of science whatsoever. What I have a hatred of is the dogmatism that stymies science. I want to have conversations like this in the mainstream, right? Because Mark is approaching this from a scientific, you know, methodology. I mean, the man's been a physics teacher, a mathematics teacher for decades, right? Pat and I certainly have no vendetta against science itself as a discipline. What I do have an issue with is it as an institution, a dogmatic institution that mediates what we can and cannot talk about and explore intellectually. I think that's the problem.
Sure is.
You know,
It seems
so.
like when you take any of these ideologies and you turn them into an institution, immediately it starts to become regressive.
Yeah, and in some cases, well, you know, there's a parallel between the scientific movement and Christianity that I draw out in my essay. The Roman Church was the seat of authority that tried to suppress the scientific movement. And Christianity arose in a comparable way. The early Christian movement that about a lifetime after Jesus was executed, he was spreading all over the Eastern Mediterranean and appealing to not just the downtrodden and conquered, but to many more, higher and higher class Romans. This movement was a liberating movement, not in the sense that it was a revolutionary movement to change society, but in that it taught that all people were equal as children of God, and they could all come together, master and servant, man and woman, to share the Lord's Supper and share in the eternal life. And that mutual aid, the practice of compassion and sharing, was mandatory within these sub-communities of Christians. That was a liberation, to believe that even if you were a slave, your life was of ultimate value, and that you were one with the people around you who shared that belief. So, of course, the Roman authorities reacted. People were exiled, imprisoned, some were executed. But that didn't stop the movement. It may have actually accelerated it. It was only in, I think, the 4th century when the Emperor Constantine supposedly converted to Christianity, having a vision after a victory that he saw the Christian Cairo symbol in the sky, coming with words, "In this sign, conquer."
Right.
He converted and issued a proclamation of tolerance for Christians. Not long after that, Christianity was assimilated by the Roman Empire when he became emperor and became the new state religion. The Roman
Exactly.
Empire's religions had crumbled. It was suffering the barbarian invasions that brought new religions in. The traditional state God's religion had failed. Others from the Middle East were coming in. So this clamped it down. This was what a Roman citizen believed. And before long, they were exiling heretics. The church became
Exactly.
highly authoritarian. At the origin, it wasn't at all. There were several different centers where there were large concentrations of Christians. There was no unified doctrine. There wasn't even a unified gospel for some time. The different
Yep.
gospels propagated mostly in different regions. Then you, but
Exactly.
after the Roman Empire adopted it, the church became a totalitarian hierarchy with centrally appointed and ordered bishops and so forth. So,
Christianity ceased becoming a radical movement and it became a replacement for the state religion of the Roman Empire, which was an institution that reinforced the hierarchical structure of the empire.
exactly. And exactly the same thing happened in the rise of scientism after the scientific revolution. Those in power were originally threatened by it, but they saw great promise in what it could do for technology and for especially the technology of weapons, which it took a while to do, but then it really did it in spades, man. It was assimilated by those in power into an accessory to domination. Those are the two most prominent examples in the history in Western history that I know of, where a threatening ideology and movement couldn't be crushed and instead was assimilated and turned against, dramatically against, its original spirit.
Right. Well, that's just it. It's almost as if when this sort of thing happens, it ceases to have a spirit altogether, you know.
Or it gets an evil spirit, if we can speak in those terms.
Right. I mean, I can't tell you how many times, and I have many friends, and I've known many people who they're very highly intelligent folks, but as soon as you put them in some sort of classroom or give them some sort of regimented way of learning about something, it's just like they can't get it, you know. And there's something to be said about the sort of creative, dynamic environment that was at the root of science and was at the root of, you know, the original Christians and these sort of revolutionary, iconoclastic thoughts and ideas that came out of it.
That's the human spirit. That's us. One big aspect of it.
Right, absolutely. And I totally, wholeheartedly agree with you there. No doubt about it.
But quite naturally, if that same spirit were turned against the structures in power, it could overthrow them. So that spirit has to be suppressed.
You know, this is what Chomsky, I guess, would call soft power when he talks about soft power and manufacturing consent. You know, he discusses taking, you know, basically structures of power have learned how to be, proactive in taking a control of popular radical movements and incorporating them into the system.
Yep, they're very, very good at it.
There's so many things I want to talk to you about, Mark. I guess let's move on. Let's talk. Let me talk first about a video that you put out since we last spoke. Landholding by Force of Arms, Our Fundamental Problem. You can check it out on YouTube. Let's talk about that briefly. It's a short video. Basically, the thesis is that. Honestly, I think you were probably influenced a little bit by Proudhon here in this video.
Not really.
It made me think of Proudhon, though. It certainly did when I was watching it. That our fundamental problem is the coercive relationship of property, essentially.
Property in the sense of landhold.
Right.
The film grew out. I have a number of dear anarcho-capitalist friends who friended me on Facebook after Engines of Domination came out.
Yeah.
To say the least, I strongly disagree with anarcho-capitalism.
I don't think it exists.
Well, I'm afraid it does exist, and the people who believe it in good conscience, but I believe they're gravely mistaken because they take landholding by force of arms to be natural. Property in the sense of belongings is a whole different thing than property in the sense of holding land by force, because everything comes from the land.
Exactly, that's the distinction. Yeah.
And the means of production are second in the order of the violation of nature, because when a small number of people control where everything comes from and what's made of it, then they're controlling everything about the human community. And that can only be maintained by force. Lands were held in common universally, as far as anyone can tell, at least as far as I know. Lands were held in common until the beginning of domination, about 6,000 years ago. And they were still held in common in all the places that the empires conquered right up to the present day. It works. Holding land in common doesn't mean that you can't allocate it for private use by clans, families, individuals. That's commonly done. It was done at the Pueblo near Taos, where I live.
It absolutely was. Yeah.
So, it's that institution that is essential for capitalism, and the idea that it's natural and inevitable, unless the communists do it, is an essential part of the ideology of capitalism. So I was thinking about this and thinking how to make an argument that concisely refuted the possibility of any real anarchist supporting that position.
Yeah.
and came up with a nice little script, and Justin made this ravishing 4-minute film.
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
Isn't that gorgeous? So
I don't know if any Justin's extremely talented. Yeah.
Oh, he's a genius. I don't know if any anarcho-capitalists have ever seen it, but I'm very glad it's out there, because I think it hits the core of the problem of connecting anarchism to land use and to the destruction of the habitat.
And I think that's a deep fundamental there, you know, and especially it also makes me think of David Graeber's work, which I harp on constantly. Please read it, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, where he goes to the anthropological record and takes a look at partially land use in that book and the division of land. And you're absolutely right. Land is held in common, and it can be used privately. It can be used for the community or certain clans, certain tribes, et cetera, right? But most of the time, before 6,000 years ago, in Mesopotamia, the Levant, we find this first springing of private land use. Now, 6,000 years on, we hold it as some kind of sacred thing. David Graeber says it in one passage about debt. He encountered a person who said, "Well, surely someone must pay their debts, right?" It's now become so fundamental to our belief system that there's private property and you have to pay your debts and all these things. We can't imagine another world. But it was not so for the first 100,000 years of human history.
More like 250,000.
Yeah, right, yeah. At least as far back as we can trace accurately how people lived. Absolutely. So it's kind of shocking, and it's illuminating. I would encourage people, again, if you're on your binge watch list, watch Engines of Domination and watch Landholding by Force of Arms. Both brilliantly put together videos and excellent information. Landholding is excellent, and I'd encourage all of our anarcho-capitalist friends, those of whom who still listen to the show, to take a look at that.
That goes to the heart of my argument against anarcho-capitalism. These people believe that without the state, the natural free market, the ideal form of human society, would take over in how we conducted our human affairs, in how we produced, distributed, exchanged goods and services, labor, and so forth. Yet, in the absence of the state, how are they going to maintain their private property? How are they going to hold their land? They have to have private security agencies, or they have to arm themselves and patrol the borders of their own farm.
Right.
It would reproduce the state in a privatized form.
Right. Who's going to enforce the capitalist mindset?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Honestly, Mark, I think it's cognitive dissonance. It's an ideology based on cognitive dissonance. There is no way. Even Adam Smith in Wealth and Nations did not believe that capitalism could exist without a state. He just simply did not. And he said it very upfrontly, there is no manner in which the capitalist system could be recreated without the state, without creating something that was essentially the state. It's impossible. And I've racked my brain trying to, find some situation where you could have the quote unquote free markets that they talk about without a state system. I cannot arrive at a conclusion that wouldn't have some institution that represents the state.
Certainly not for as far as the private ownership of land and means of production are concerned. Now, the last time I spoke with you guys, Patrick mentioned anarcho-fascism, and I thought he was joking, but I looked into it since then. Wow. That would be the privatized state in a highly granular form with the different privately owned regions,
exactly,
each having their own management.
I actually had the same conversation not just a few days ago with our friend John Carrico. John's been a guest on the program, and I know that you, Mark, know John. Mm-hmm. I mentioned anarcho-fascism to him the other day in the context of a totally separate conversation, and he said, "Wow, what the hell is that?"
You know, that's the the reaction anarcho-capitalism gets in many parts of Europe. My European friends have told me they think it's a joke.
It's a very American thing, I think. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to be negative. As I said, these friends of mine, I know they're well-meaning, and they work real hard to propagate their ideas. They're very creative, and I have to let them go their way and not get bogged down in arguments with them. But for some people who may be flirting with the philosophy and considering it, I hope from time to time to put out a little something that might give them pause about it.
Well, my big thing on anarcho-capitalism is this. If we're living in a truly anarchist society and you choose to use your capitalist system, right, then if it truly worked, then everyone would probably use it, right, if it was truly the best way to do things. But it's inevitable that at some point, and probably pretty damn quick, people are going to come up with alternatives that makes capitalism, look like some sort of – look like the scheme that it really is. So if that were to happen, if there's all these other competing economic ideas or methods that pop up, what good is it to be an anarcho-capitalist? You know what I mean? So it's like one of those things. It's like, sure, you can call yourself an anarcho-capitalist all you want, but when push comes to shove and we actually were in this sort of situation where we could choose our own economic or a way to, manage an economy or transfer goods or what have you, then I'm willing to bet a large amount that capitalism is not going to stick around very long.
Who would choose the wage system over cooperative production?
Yeah.
And mutual aid and sharing. That's another place where I think anarcho-capitalism falls really short of what anarchism has always meant. They take the wage system for granted, that your time is a commodity and that someone can buy your time. And in fact, that you have to do that unless you can rise up enough in the class structure to buy somebody else's time. So you don't have to do what you're hiring them to do. As far as I know, the wage system has been opposed by almost all forms of anarchism traditionally as a kind of oppression, a kind of institutionalized inequality and hierarchy.
It always has been. It always has been. Even in the syndicalist movement, which focuses mostly on workers, the end goal has always been the abolishment of the wage system. That's never been an anarchist value.
And it's only been a human institution since they drove the peasants into the cities and foreclosed the commons about 500 years ago.
Exactly.
There have always been people who exchanged work for money. And I know money can be a very useful thing in the sense of some commonly accepted medium of exchange. Not necessarily.
And money in the broadest term we're talking about here, even thousands of years ago when we didn't have regulated currency, money, we're talking about units of exchange.
It was probably never a single unit. There were probably many, a collection of many things that in a given region people were glad to generally take in exchange. But the artisans, craftsmen, and so forth certainly worked for money in the Greek and Roman worlds. But that's not a wage system. What people getting paid isn't the same as you having to either pay someone to work for you or be paid to work or starve.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the modern wage system. And I think, honestly, the anarcho-capitalists are they're swallowing the pill of the oppressor, right? And it's mostly – a lot of it, I think, is this kind of strange, mostly right-wing ideal – that you must be subservient to that wage system, that there aren't any alternatives, that that's the best way to go, right? Like, like, if you work X number of hours, you earn this much, and that's your choice. Like, you can choose to work 5 hours a week, or you can choose to work 80 hours a week, and your deliverance economically is based on strictly your choices. And that's just clearly false.
It's no kind of freedom. I mean, it's much more free than serfdom or slavery, but multiple choice freedom is no freedom at all.
Exactly.
Unless you can choose as a community, unless a community can choose what system they want, they aren't really free.
Yeah, absolutely. And that'll lead us into the upcoming project, which I'm very excited about. I've been excited about it for some time. Provo. You and Justin are working on a new video. Tell us a little bit about Provo, Mark.
Okay, Provo doesn't mean what happened in Ireland or a city in Utah. Provo was an anarchist youth movement in Amsterdam that only ran from 1965 to 1967. It's not well known, almost unknown outside Europe, partly because most of the literature about it and films about it are in Dutch. But it had a tremendous impact on the Netherlands that lasted right into this century. It's a marvelous story. These people were serious anarchists, not ideologically, because they didn't really have an ideology. They held anarchism as an ideal. They were living in a country that had been devastated by World War II. 4/5 of the Jewish population exterminated in the death camps. Famines that were so severe that people ate tulip bulbs. Really, really horrible experience in the war. Then a rapid reconstruction and return to wealth. The Netherlands is a very rich country. Need I say Royal Dutch Shell? Provo is remarkable because it came together spontaneously out of a number of very unlikely factors. And most of all, these people decided to be playful. They took an approach to nonviolent resistance through street happenings. The happening was a new art form in those days. It had just come to Northern, actually it had just come to the first major happening was in Amsterdam. They decided to use this as their vehicle for provoking the authorities. They had no ambitions to have a revolution or overthrow the powers that be. They knew that was impossible. They didn't have anything like the numbers of people committed to do that. So instead, they decided to provoke the authorities into taking actions that would show their real nature. And they succeeded brilliantly and hilariously. Justin decided to do this film after Engines, long before I joined the project. I got involved in writing the script about a year ago. We both did tons of research, very difficult because of the Dutch sources, and you find a lot of things on the internet that are inaccurate or exaggerated or give different accounts of things. It's really hard to sort out what really happened. But we got a pretty good script together, and Justin's rising to new heights in the filmmaking on this, including a lot of marvelous animation and collage animation, as well as historical pictures and footage. So we're really excited about this because these people were in love with creativity. And the way they decided what to do and how they did it just illustrates so beautifully my long-held belief that since the engine of domination was invented through human creativity, our big hope in overcoming it is human creativity, because they succeeded. Also, that we hope this film will inspire activists to put their whole range of creative powers into their work and not get stuck in traditional forms that are easily countered by the authorities. Very excited about this film. I think it's going to be fantastic. And don't ask me when we'll be done, because every time we thought we knew, some further problem arose and we had to delay our expectations. We'll know much better when it'll be done sometime by the middle of next year. Big project, feature-length film.
That's exciting. I can't wait to see that, right. You know?
Absolutely, and I really hope it makes a big splash in the American anarchist community, you know?
Oh, we'd love it too. The things these people did, they had the provocations in street happenings, but they also matched those up against what they called white plans, proposals for improving life in the Netherlands, especially in Amsterdam. It started as a local movement. By the time they disbanded 2 years later, there were Provo movements all over the Netherlands, and they were beginning to spring up in other European countries. In fact, Provo was a major inspiration for the Prague and Paris student uprisings. But the first of these white plans was called the White Bike Plan. It's actually, more people probably know about the White Bike, know about Provo through the White Bike Plan than any other way. They proposed that 20,000 free white bicycles should be provided by the city and left unlocked. The city center was getting extremely crowded, and planners were proposing to bring in more highways to bring in more cars. So Provo said, ban all motor vehicles except electric taxis from the city center and put these bikes out. So when you needed a bike, you grab a bike, and when you had ridden it where you wanted it, you just leave it there. Some people in Amsterdam were really enthusiastic about this, but the city didn't take up the plan. So what does Provo do? They get together some dozens of white bicycles and take them to their usual meeting place at the square in central Amsterdam, paint them white, and leave them on the streets. What do the police do? The police confiscate the bikes because it's illegal to leave unlocked bikes out. What does Provo do? They put a combination light bike on the lock and paint the combination on the bike.
Okay.
The police keep fighting back, and this leads into the continual dialogue that Provo had with the city authorities of provocations and arrests. Another marvelous thing they did was subvert the royal wedding of the Crown Princess of the Netherlands to a German former soldier and member of the Hitler Youth. They put out these rumors, these white rumors, about what they were going to do for anti-wedding festivities. The princess had chosen to be married in Amsterdam, which was a former major Jewish enclave in the Netherlands before the war. So there was a lot of opposition to at least having the wedding held there, and it was also a center of Republican beliefs that opposed the monarchy. The wedding's going to be in Amsterdam. Provo proposes an anti-wedding with anti-festivities, including anti-fireworks. They put out this white rumor plan that they're going to do things like play machine gun sounds to confuse the police, or put lion shit in the streets to scare the horses, or put laughing gas in the church organ to come out during the wedding ceremony. Or they put out a leaflet that says, from reliable sources, we have learned that certain groups are planning actions that could be very dangerous to the citizens of Amsterdam. They're going to give LSD to the horses of the mounted police. The result of an absolutely uncontrollable horse in a tightly packed crowd is clear. So the press goes wild and says they're going to put it in the water system. The international press picks up on this and starts asking Provo to disclose their plans. Turns out all they do is release a bunch of white smoke bombs during the wedding procession from the city hall to the church. Makes international publicity, these huge, beautiful white clouds of smoke rising up over the wedding carriage during the wedding procession from the city hall to the church. It got on international TV and in international newspapers, these beautiful white clouds on this dark, rainy day rising over the royal carriage. It was gorgeous. And they succeeded in showing. And in the meantime, thousands and thousands of demonstrators had collected in central Amsterdam. They went on setting off smoke bombs throughout the day. They'd succeeded in really showing how much popular opposition there was to this wedding. These guys were incredible.
You know, it's such an inspiration, because I've always said that there should be
Within your activism, I mean, we can't be angry all the time. There should be some joy in it. There should be some creativity in it. You know? Make a lifestyle of it. You know? That's something that we need to do. That, you know, we need to... If this is what we're going to... if we're going to change society, we need to make it joyful. We need to make it rejoiceful. You know,
we should need some joy in it. The provost did make it a lifestyle. They practiced mutual aid. They believed in free love and tried not to be possessive about their girlfriends and boyfriends. The beauty of it is their creativity ran down. The authorities versus Provo became kind of a running story in Amsterdam as the movement was spreading to other cities and setting off new exciting events. And as the momentum waned, these people had the good sense to call it quits. They thought that they'd set something in motion that would take a different form after they were gone. Some of them wanted to move more into domestic politics. In the process of all this, they got one of their members elected to the city council. Probably would have gotten more elected if the minimum voting age hadn't been 23. It was a youth movement, and a large part of its following was youthful. But they decided to just call it quits and liquidate Provo, which kept them from getting stale and institutionalized, like so many radical movements do. It had lost its oomph, so they got off the bicycle. Nonetheless, they had set trends in motion in the Netherlands. They had released a creative impulse for reform and renewal that culminated in the Netherlands being one of the world's most tolerant countries for a long time. It's not now. The fascist forces that are gaining strength everywhere in Europe are making their own strides. In the Netherlands, there's a huge anti-refugee surge there. And I suspect that the civil liberties are going too. But they had a huge impact. Did they make a revolution? No, they didn't intend to make a revolution. They made life better for a long time for a lot of people, and not just Netherlanders. There's always that trade-off between the long-term goal and what can be accomplished now to make things better for those around us. And I think any successful movement to transform the world has got to incorporate both. Like when anarchists debate about whether to get into electoral politics here in the States over Sanders, some of them say I'd be betraying my anarchism if I voted for anybody. They're all crooks. It's all a sham. It's all rigged. Provo got elected to the city council, and they had a big impact on how things went in Amsterdam for a while. Eventually, six of them were on the city council in the United States. I don't think there's any question that there is a prospect of making things better for a lot of Americans if Sanders wins.
Exactly. I'm wading into that argument myself. I'm wading into that argument myself here publicly. I don't think we need to, we can't leave any tools lying in the toolbox. We need to use them all, right? That's my standpoint. Yeah.
Well, and you have to make concessions. We're under a power system that is an electoral system in the United States. Yes, in fact, although electing Sanders wouldn't have any chance of changing the fundamental system, it could give popular forces for some reforms an incredible leverage, at least for a few years. Certainly, exactly. The legislature could be stacked against him. The reforms might be limited. On the other hand, succeeding in the reforms could blunt popular pressure against the system. You know, we've made some progress. Now we can, you know, kick back and relax. Those are dangers. There's dangers that it would make it appear that the system works to people who were previously completely opposed to the system. But we're stuck in this situation. How do we weigh the well-being of ourselves and those around us in the immediate future against some prospect of what we ultimately absolutely must do to save ourselves and the world, of eliminating domination completely? It's a tough choice, and it's a personal choice, but I think it's a mistake to rule out that any good could be done by by actually encouraging the popularity of Sanders and doing our best to get him in office. That's my choice. I respect other people's choices, but I sure disagree with those who just dismiss it out of hand.
I think you're right, Mark, and I agree with that statement completely, and that is my standpoint as well. I think, again, we need to we can use the political tool to improve people's lives in the short term, and I think that's our goal, isn't it? I mean, as radicals, revolutionaries, whatever you want to call us, our goal is to improve the lives of human beings. And if I can do that now in the short term while creating a climate in which further liberation ideology can be espoused, I'm going to do it. You know.
Back to Provo for a moment. We've been in touch with the movement's founder, this at the time young and brilliant anarchist thinker and writer named Roel van Daun. He's enthusiastic about our project, and we just feel incredibly flattered that that's the case.
That's fantastic. No, that's fantastic. Do you have a release date?
No way. No way. Yes. As I said earlier, so, we'll have a better idea by the middle of next year, but it won't be anytime really soon. It's a huge project. The animation is incredibly time consuming.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. And I've been, honestly, I figured that'd be your answer because I've been trying to get a release date out of you or Justin for the last, I don't know, 6 months. But I'm very much looking forward to it, Mark. I'm really looking forward to it. Definitely, I'm gonna have you or Justin, or you and Justin, on the show when it is released, so we can really get in depth about the finished product and promote it, because I'm really excited about it.
That would be great. Yeah. And we should really take time sometime to say more about what Provo did and how it succeeded, because the story is so inspiring.
Well, why don't you give me some highlights right now, here at the end of the show. Give me a few of the things that stick out in your mind. Talk about some of the key points.
Well, the most remarkable one overall is how the movement originated. Three completely separate factors came together unexpectedly and unintentionally. First off, the happening art form had been created in New York right around 1960. The most remarkable thing is really how the movement came together. There were three apparently unrelated factors that no one could have foreseen combining. First of all was the new art form of the happening that originated in New York just before 1960. It started among the elite avant-garde art scene there, grew out of the abstract expressionist school, which included folks like Jackson Pollock. Everybody knows him. Yeah. One of the abstract expressionists named Alan Capro took the abstract expressionist's experimental art form of action painting farther and started exhibiting weird collections of objects in galleries. Then he came up with the idea of the happening, where strange events would be scheduled and the audience would follow scripted instructions, and it would just be the experience, this unpredictable experience. And it made a big splash in the art scene, and then in a few years later it had spread to the hippie scene, where the happening was kind of a tribal ritual. But that had only come to Europe in the Netherlands in the very early 1960s. I think it was 1962. So that was one factor. Second factor, the demography of the of Amsterdam after World War II. As the prosperity increased, a generation of people who were just children during the war grew up, kind of like the juvenile delinquent scene in the United States, kind of like the Teddy Boys in England, but quite different. These people were called the Nozems for a reason that we haven't been able to figure out definitively. They weren't rich, but they weren't poor. They were some of the working and middle classes. They were resentful that there wasn't more to life than this booming prosperity. They wanted excitement. They wanted to be different from the straight-laced Netherlands stereotype. They hung around in groups, two groups, one, both rode mopeds, some cheaper, some more expensive. Some wore leather jackets, some dressed in black like the Paris existentialists. The groups had confrontations, commonly, not like gang war, just sullen, belligerent, sometimes fights. They loved to confront the police. So there was this element of street people. And one of them turned out to be where the happenings in the Netherlands became a prelude to Provo. This guy was incredible. His name was Robert Jasper Hoogveld. And it's a long, long story, but he ended up holding street happenings at a statue called the Little Darling, Het Lieverdje, in central Amsterdam, as part of his anti-smoking crusade. He had decided that advertising and publicity were magic, and he had to become a magician to counteract the tobacco companies and advertisers' magic spell. And he gathered quite a large following through the happenings that preceded this. Every Saturday night at midnight, this crowd of his followers and an increasingly large public would meet at the statue and light a big fire under the statue. Hoogveld would appear in some strange costume and give some kind of sermon. These became big events in dull Amsterdam. So then Van Down decided to start the Provo movement when he read an article about the Nozems, where the author had called them Provos, from the Dutch word professera, to provoke. Van Down said, I read the classical anarchists. They said the working classes would start the revolution. No way in the Netherlands. The working classes have been assimilated into the ruling classes. They sit and watch TV, and they wouldn't lose their jobs for anything. So,
yep, I think this is the key. This is the key fundamental difference between anarchists and communists. There,
yeah. Yes, certainly today, anyway. So he said, we mustn't expect anything from the proletariat. We need the provotariat, and he decided to start a new magazine called Provo. To advocate nonviolent confrontations with the authorities. So while passing out a leaflet for one of these leaflets, he went to the square where Hoogveld was holding one of his happenings. Hoogveld read the leaflet. His father had been an anarchist. He proposed a collaboration. He said the magicians and the activists have to work together. So it was that fusion of all of those factors. Once Provo started meeting at the Lieverdje and working with Grootveld's incredibly weird imagination, the things just went bam and lit up for Provo.
That's awesome. Yeah, that sounds like quite the film there, Mark.
Well, that has a lesson for activists, though, not to get stuck in ruts, because no one would have ever thought some factors like these would come together into an effective resistance movement. So people have to be on the lookout for new ideas and be willing to fail at trying new ideas.
And, you know,
combination may
work. Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, when the film, you know, prior to its release date, we're most definitely going to have you on and have a lengthy discussion on just that topic, you know, on creative ways of protest and political upheaval. But unfortunately here, I have to run. So it was a fantastic talk with you, Mark. Probably one of the better interviews we've had in terms of anarchism and the underlying themes. Yeah, loved having you on.
My pleasure.
Yeah, Mark, why don't you give us your contact information and your websites real quick here?
The simplest contact is my website, which is just enginesofdomination.com. Everything's there. Links to the films, link to my books. Contact window where people can find me on Facebook easily, or my Engines of Domination page on Facebook.
Yeah, great. And that also includes your new blog, I believe, right, Mark? So
yeah, which I've been woefully neglecting in favor of my writing.
Well, that's probably a good thing. Yeah. So, all right, we're going to head out then. This has been the Free Radical Media Podcast. Myself and Patrick Ryan. Myself being Eric Scott Picard, our guest Mark Korski. You'll have his information in the video or the stream of the podcast here. And you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr,
and Instagram, most of your other social media outlets, go ahead and look us up and our webpage at freeradicalmedia.net. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody, and we'll be back for you soon with another interesting interview.